Well, we're ready for chapter 11 in the first volume of Needham's history, which he entitles The Fall of Rome and the New Germanic Kingdoms. Last night we were talking about the long and complicated discussions and controversies that took place with regard to understanding the person and the nature of Christ. And that came to an end of sorts with the councils, the Council of Nicaea 325, a Council of Constantinople in 381 that reaffirmed what Nicaea had decided, and then a council at Chalcedon in 451 that came to a final consensus about the person and work of Christ, or the person of Christ as being God and man in one person. Something that's not entirely clear to me, and Needham, I think, doesn't make it clear. He says at the end of the chapter on Arianism that with the decision at Constantinople, Arianism within the Catholic Church came to an end, that the Church had made its decision. And yet it's quite clear in this chapter that Arianism continues. It must be outside the Catholic Church, but I don't know for sure what that looked like, whether there was any kind of organization of Arian churches, or whether they went on somewhat independently of one another. That's not clear in the book, and it's not clear to me. But it is clear that there were still Arian bishops and Arian churches around. And as the Germanic tribes come into the picture, when they became Christian, they became Christian in the Arian form. And so there is a continuing life of Arianism even after the councils had made their decisions. You don't have then at this period a single unified Catholic Church. There is a diversion. There is a diversity among those who profess to be Christians. Well, the fall of Rome takes place. It's called that because it's the end of the Roman Empire, and Rome itself being ruled by those who were of Roman descent. There's still a city of Rome, but it comes under the domination of German tribes at this point. This came about because there was an attack from the east by a man by the name of Attila the Hun. Now, you may know that from Rush Limbaugh, who's in the Attila the Hun chair when he broadcasts. And the idea of, or the reputation of Attila the Hun is of a very bloodthirsty and a cruel leader, and that was true, in fact. And he comes from the east, and he's invading Europe and conquering territory. And he attacks the German tribes that lived in eastern and northern Europe. One interesting perspective on that: I had a short trip to Romania, and was among Hungarian people there. And it was at the time of high school graduation, June. And so there would be in storefronts, there would be pictures of the graduating class and with their names of the students. And one thing that struck me was a fair number of the students had the name Attila. And so these are Hungarians. This is Attila the Hun. And apparently in their tradition, Attila was an admirable character, and so they named their sons Attila. That's different from his reputation in the West. Well, there are scattered German tribes. They form confederacies to defend themselves against Attila, and names that are, most of them, somewhat unfamiliar to us, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, the Franks, they become the French, the Vandals, we have vandalism today, it's because of what the Vandals did to Rome in by way of destruction. The Lombards, they were from northern Italy. The Burgundians, that's a territory in France. Angles and Saxons and Jutes, they're all from the British Isles. They end up, I mean, they invade and end up in the British Isles. And these German tribes, as they are being attacked by Attila the Hun, cross over the Danube River, that would be to the south, and they're warlike, and so they begin to fight with the Romans. So it's a very chaotic time, a time of great movement of peoples territorially, and it's a time of trouble for those who had lived in Rome. But in this process, there is the expansion of Christianity to these German tribes, although it's Christianity in its Arian form. There was a missionary, a bishop by the name of Ulfilas, who was an Arian, who evangelized the Visigoths and, in fact, translated the Bible into their language. And it was these folks who sacked Rome in 410. And that's pointed to that date, 410, is pointed to as the fall of Rome. Rome is never the same after that. And then they went on from there and settled in France. The Vandals conquered France and Spain and northwest Africa. So here's a German tribe that comes and takes over what had been a prominent part of the Roman Empire. And their king persecuted Christians then as they took over those territories. In fact, Augustine died while Hippo was being besieged by the Vandals in 430 A.D. There continued to be a Roman emperor in name, although his power was limited, but in 476, the emperor Romulus Augustulus was deposed, and a German general was named to be king. And these events, it spread over a period of time, result in the end of the Roman Empire in the West. Later, there comes to be something called the Holy Roman Empire, but it's on a new basis, and it really is centered in Germany rather than Germany and Spain rather than in Rome. So at the end of the 5th century, the situation was like this, thinking about the territories. The Visigoths were in control of Spain, and they were Arian Christians. The Burgundians controlled France. They were also Arian. The Vandals ruled in northwest Africa, also Arian. But still in other parts of France, tribes called the Franks were in charge. They were still pagan, and Britain was still a pagan. So in the West, what had been the western part of the Roman Empire, you have some territories that are Arian Christian and others that are still pagan. The Franks became nominally Christian when their king, Clovis, married a Catholic lady. Clotilda was her name, and she tried to persuade him to become a Christian. In a battle in 496, he prayed to Christ for victory, and when he won the victory, he was baptized as a Christian. And so among these Germanic tribes, the Franks became the first Christian, the first Catholic kingdom. And we'll talk later about the Muslims, and even later than that, we'll talk about the Crusades. One of the distressing things about this whole period is that religion is being spread by military conquests. Not only the Muslims doing that, but also various brands of Christians doing that. And in the case of the Franks, here we have what is regarded as the conversion of the whole tribe to Christianity, but what's the meaning of that? How significant is it? Needham comments that most of the Franks had embraced the faith in a shallow and external way. You can understand that. It's related to what the king does, and the king says to his people, you are to be baptized, and so they are baptized. We look at that from our perspective at the present time, and we are quite focused on individual faith. And I think that's right. I think it's right, but it's a different way of thinking about things than was true in these earlier periods, in which people thought in a more communal or corporate way. And so that is a factor here. Needham, after he makes this comment about the shallow and external way in which people had embraced Christianity, adds in a footnote, perhaps things are not so different in churches today. And so we continue to deal with the fact that there are tares on wheat, and that for many the profession of Christianity is superficial, not personal and individual and deep. So we have Christianity spreading. It's hard to know how many of these folks are really converted and really are saved people. There is a mention here, it's just kind of an interesting sidelight, about a writer by the name of Boethius, who was the author of a work called The Consolation of Philosophy. He was killed by King Theodoric of the Ostrogoths in 524. But the interesting thing about his book, The Consolation of Philosophy, is that it was read very widely for 1,000 years, and he was a professing Christian. But in this book about the consolation of philosophy, he never mentions the name of Christ. And the perspective of the book is that of Neoplatonism. So we've talked about synthesis and antithesis, relation between faith and reason, relation between Christianity and philosophy. And this would point to a strong tendency towards synthesis. Christian people in Europe reading this book, The Consolation of Philosophy, which is not explicitly and overtly Christian. That's what we're calling synthesis. Boethius was influential in that he shaped the educational curriculum of the Middle Ages, and people who went to school, which would be a relatively small number of boys. Girls did not go to school. Some of the wealthier women would be educated perhaps at home, but school was for boys and only for the upper classes. But the curriculum was divided into two parts, what was called the trivium, a three-part curriculum in grammar, rhetoric, and logic, and then the quadrivium, which was arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. As a part of this synthesis of philosophy with faith, Boethius translated Aristotle into Latin. So it became accessible. Aristotle's writings became accessible to people in the West. And we'll talk later about Thomas Aquinas, a very influential theologian in Catholicism, who comes later, but he is one who takes Aristotle and tries to put together Aristotle with Christian theology. Most of the German tribes then, when they came to be nominally Christian, did so in the Arian form at the beginning, but over time they gradually became more Orthodox and became Catholics. The Burgundians in 517, the Spanish Visigoths in 589, and the Italian Lombards later on, between 712 and 744. The point here is that the conflict with Arianism was not really finally settled until the 8th century, and then, and as far as there being Arian churches and bishops and so on, Arianism disappeared for a while. It keeps coming back. And we mentioned last night the Jehovah's Witnesses who hold that view of Christ. In this chapter, Needham mentions the founding of another kind of monastic order, the Benedictine order, founded by Benedict of Nursia in 529. And he developed what was called the rule for this order. And you can think about how you would like this kind of a schedule for your life. The brothers who were in the monastery spent 4.5 hours a day in collective worship. So that was a big part of the day. Then 6 to 7 hours in manual labor. So the worship would come quite early in the morning. Then when it got daylight, you would go out and work in the fields and so forth. And then after 6 or 7 hours of manual labor, 3 to 5 hours of study of the Bible and of the church fathers. And that left about 8 hours for sleeping. So no electric lights, no television. You go to bed early in the evening and get up very early in the morning. And the monastery was ruled by an abbot who was elected for life and who had final authority over the members of the order, although he was expected to do that in consultation with the monks of the order. And this is an appropriate time, I think, maybe as we talk about monasticism, to deal with what John Calvin said about monasticism. Needham says, this is on page 198 in the book, Needham says, present-day evangelical Christians will probably find monasticism very strange, perhaps repellent, and may wonder how true believers in the 4th century could possibly have established and approved such a system. It may be helpful to listen to some of the good things that John Calvin says about the early monks, and this is in the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Calvin says, "If anyone tries to defend present-day monasticism by arguing that it is a very ancient practice, we must note that a very different way of life once prevailed in monasteries. Those who wanted to exercise themselves in the greatest self-discipline and patience retired there. They slept on the ground. They drank only water. Their food was bread, vegetables, and roots. Their luxuries were oil and chickpeas. They abstained from all feasting and pampering of the body." These things might seem exaggerated if experienced eyewitnesses, Gregory of Nazianzus, Basil and Chrysostom, those will be familiar names to you now, if they had not handed them down to us. By means of these simple disciplines, the monks prepared themselves for greater tasks. For the fathers we have just mentioned give clear enough proof that monastic colleges were, so to speak, training centers for the clergy. These fathers themselves were first reared in monasteries and then called to the office of bishop. Augustine shows that in his day, the monasteries usually supplied the church with clergy. Godly men normally prepared themselves by monastic discipline to exercise office in the church, so that the monasteries might make them fitter and better trained for so great a ministry. I merely wish to indicate in passing what sort of monks the early church had and what sort of monastic life then existed. Thus, intelligent readers may judge by comparison how shameless those men are who try to claim the early church to defend present-day monasticism. So his idea is that monasticism at the time of the Reformation, centuries later, almost 1,000 years later from what we're where we are now, had deteriorated in a very serious way. And when he thinks about the monasteries as a kind of seminaries, I'm reminded of something I heard about Sam Boyle. And I only have this by second report, but when he first graduated from seminary, he was pastor of the East End Church, which was not far from the seminary, still single. And I've heard that he used to come over at mealtime and thought they ought to do like the monks did and so have reading of edifying literature during mealtime. So he read to the other students. So I've heard. And so he tried to make the RP Seminary a monastery in that modest way. To think about the deterioration of monasticism in later times, Mary and I had a trip once to Yorkshire, northern England, and we visited the ruins of a huge monastery called Fountain Abbey. You could tell that it had been a beautiful building, but the roof and the windows were gone. You had the kind of the Gothic-shaped window openings left, but the building was in ruins. It had been closed down at the time of Henry VIII, when he closed monasteries and laid hands on the money, the possessions that they had. But this was a different monastic order. This was the Cistercian order, and we'll come to that later on. They had all taken vows of poverty. But the guide who took us around, who was, I think, a Catholic, talked about how much property this monastery owned. Thousands of rich farmland all around the monastery. And he commented, how do they, and a group of monks who had vowed poverty, get to be so wealthy? And the reason was, of course, built in with the idea of prayers for the dead and masses for the dead, that people would leave in their will land to the monastery upon agreement that prayers would be said for the release of their souls from purgatory. And so, whether they aimed for it or not, the monastery became enormously wealthy. And then that led to all kinds of temptations to worldliness simply because of the money that they were in control of. So there was clearly degeneration over time. Well, when the political institutions of Rome collapsed under the attack by the Germanic tribes, the Catholic Church in Rome and in Western Europe, as Needham says, was the one great Roman institution which survived. And so the Catholic Church, through the political collapse, became more powerful and more influential. And one of the men who brought that about is one called Gregory the Great. Here's another one of the greats, and I'm still trying to find the committee that decided who would have that designation. He's Gregory the First. There's another very prominent Gregory later on, Gregory the Seventh. But Gregory the First really advanced the claims of the papacy. He was born in 540 in Rome. He became a Benedictine monk. And this fits in with what Calvin said. The men went to the monastery for a time and then moved out of that into more regular pastoral work. He became the Bishop of Rome in 590 and remained there until 604, so about 14 years. And he operated politically as well as religiously. He made peace with the Lombards. He established good relations with the Frankish kings. And he rejected the claim of the Patriarch of Constantinople to be universal bishop. And his claim was that the Bishop of Rome is the first among equals. But this is a step toward enhancing the prestige and the power of the Bishop of Rome. Mary asked the question last night, when did we have the first pope? And I answered it rather vaguely because it's not an easy question to answer. We had before this Leo, who made claims for the papacy but was not able to exercise them. This Gregory enhances the actual power of the papacy, but Needham says that the papacy doesn't reach really its height of power until the time of Innocent III, who begins, I think, at 1198. It's either 1098 or 1198. We'll come to him later. But we do see the papacy beginning to take shape with Gregory. He's exercising this political power as he negotiates with rulers, and claims to be the first among equals. And then he promotes doctrines and practices that later become characteristic of the Roman Catholic Church. For example, the doctrine of baptismal regeneration. that it is by means of the sacrament of baptism that grace is imparted to an infant, and at that point, through baptism, the infant is born again. If you were to ask a knowledgeable Catholic, have you been born again? They would probably point to the time of their baptism. And it wouldn't relate to a conversion experience or some conscious commitment to Christ, but a new life given through baptism. This belief, by the way, came over into the Lutheran church. And I was once at a Lutheran church where they had an infant baptism. And on the altar, they had a white rose. And after the baptism, the white rose was given to the parents. And the Lutheran pastor said, "This rose now is the symbol of the purity which your child now has because of baptism. Through baptism, he or she has been cleansed of sin and is a new creature in Christ." So this is the doctrine of baptismal regeneration. I talked earlier about a theology of baptism that led to delay. That is the idea that baptism washes away sins committed before that, but not after that. So people tended to delay. And now this is a strong reason for infant baptism, because it is held that it actually conveys salvation. The Reformed view of baptism has a different theology behind it. Gregory promoted also the idea of penance, that after baptism, in order to be forgiven of sin, a person must repent and do some kind of good deed that would gain forgiveness. And then along with that, forgiveness of sins being accomplished by the Eucharist, by the Lord's Supper or the Mass, he also developed the doctrine and promoted the doctrine of purgatory and masses for the dead. And you'll be aware that that doctrine involves the idea that when in the... This is especially as it developed later on in the Roman Catholic Church. When a person has committed a serious sin, then they have to go through the sacrament of penance, which involves contrition, feeling of sorrow for sin in the heart, and that's expressed in terms of what's called an act of contrition, that is an expression of sorrow for sin. Then, so contrition, and then confession to a priest, and then the penance itself, which is the assignment of some religious duty that's to be performed, could be something like saying a certain number of prayers or something like that. And then absolution, which is the pronouncement by the priest that the sins are forgiven. But even that, the sacrament of penance in Catholic doctrine results in the forgiveness of the eternal consequences of the sin. But it does not remove all of the temporal punishments or consequences of the sin. And if those temporal punishments are not fulfilled in this life, then they have to be fulfilled after this life in purgatory, which is a kind of a middle state between heaven and hell. And so here we are in the 6th century, and this doctrine of purgatory is now being promoted by the Bishop of Rome. Gregory opposed the use of images and icons in worship, but favored their use for education. So he thought you could have statues of Jesus and other biblical figures in the church, but they were not to be objects of devotion. And this led later on to what we will talk about, the great iconoclastic controversy, in which there was a fierce debate about the use of icons and images. Just to think about the concrete reality of this, it's quite foreign to us in our practice, but when we were over in Ireland for an Irish conference a number of years ago, we did a tour of the local town, which was in the Republic of Ireland, not in Northern Ireland, but in the Republic, which is predominantly Catholic. And inside of this church, there were images, stations of the cross around the church, and a statue of Mary, and we saw people kneeling in front of these statues and having their devotions, praying. And the other thing, it's not quite images, but it's related to it, related to the use of relics. They had in this church, in what looked kind of like a circular fireplace, you know, with a conical roof on it and so forth, they had inside of that the mummified head of the patron saint of that particular church, who in fact had been beheaded in England under Charles II, of all things, because this guy was a secret Catholic missionary. And it was illegal to be Catholic in England at that time. It's odd because Charles himself was a closet Catholic, but he was enforcing the law of the land. So the guide told us about how this head had been put in a tin box and smuggled out of England and brought there. And later on, this martyr had been declared a saint. And it really gave me a really odd feeling to see people come to this shrine where this head was and to bow down and pray in front of it. And so that was the veneration of the saints that was done there. And that's a part of the reality, I think, of what happens kind of at the grassroots level in some practice of Roman Catholicism. Perhaps the Irish are more traditional in that regard than our American Catholics, I don't know. I did mention the church in Pittsburgh that has a great collection of relics. Well, Gregory also is given credit for what's called Gregorian chant. If you know about music, you know something about this very simple kind of music. People singing in unison, sometimes also alternating as they sing. One group singing and then another group singing. And that became quite popular in the Catholic Church. Gregory wrote a book called Pastoral Care. And that's another of work on that subject from the early time that is still made use of, even in our circles. And I wanted to give you a sample of that. It's on page 316. And you can see this is kind of good Christian common sense, and maybe biblical perspective. On page 316, the pastor must keep careful watch over himself in case the craving to be popular assaults him. As he studies to understand spiritual things and as he ministers to his people, he must beware that he does not try to make the congregation love him more than they love the truth. He must take care in case his self-love puts him at a distance from his Creator, even if his good life seems to show that he does not belong to this world. For a man becomes an enemy of the Redeemer if by his good works he covets being loved by the church instead of by Christ, just as a servant sent by the bridegroom with gifts for the bride is guilty of treacherous thoughts if he desires to attract the eyes of the bride to himself. And so that's a little sample, and that's a good word. And it's a reminder to us, I've just been talking about his leading to the development of distinctive Roman Catholic doctrines, which are outside of and indeed contrary to Scripture, but there's a mixture, and there are some good things that we see in folks like Gregory. Well, coming closer to our own roots, the last part of this chapter has to do with the Celtic Church and the conversion of the English. The same Gregory that we've talked about sent a Benedictine monk named Augustine to Kent, which I think is southeastern part of England. This is not Augustine that we've talked about before. This is another one. And he is known as Augustine of Canterbury. Canterbury is located outside of London. There was a palace there that the king owned, and he gave it to Augustine for his residence. And so that's why at the present time the chief bishop in the Church of England is called the Archbishop of Canterbury, because that's his seat, though he also has residence and offices in London and operates there as well. Well, by way of this man's preaching, the king of that territory, King Ethelbert, became a Catholic about 600 A.D., and Needham reports that some 10,000 Jews were converted and baptized at this time. Now, before this time, the native people of the British Isles, called the Celts, had already become Christian. And this is a place that's rather hazy in Needham's description. He doesn't talk about it. We probably don't have good historical sources for it, but the point is there was already a church in the British Isles among some of the people, where the leadership came from monasteries and from abbots. And two of the famous people from the British Isles, Patrick and Columba, came out of that system. Patrick, we have St. Patrick's Day. He evangelized Ireland from about 432 to 461. And while he's highly regarded by Irish Catholics, if you talk with people from the Irish RP Church, they also have a very high regard for Patrick, and they think of him as a kind of Protestant before his time. Another man by the name of Columba founded a monastery at Iona, which is on the southwest coast of Scotland, and then he, with a band of 12 monks, evangelized in Scotland and in northern England. And another monk by the name of Columbanus, with, again, 12 other monks, evangelized in Europe, Burgundy, Constance, and North Italy. This was an interesting missionary and evangelistic strategy. I mentioned this, I think, last night. These were monks. They went out in groups of 13. They had a leader and then 12 others, and they were kind of consciously patterning this after Jesus and his 12 disciples. And so they had a team that went and engaged in this missionary work. Now, Augustine of Canterbury had been sent by the Pope, Pope Gregory, and so this, and you already have the Celtic Christianity that has been operating in Britain, and there came to be some clashes between those who were reached by Augustine and others from Rome and the Celtic Christians. They disagreed about things like the date of Easter and church organization, and even the style of tonsure. This is kind of a curious, odd thing. They shaved the top of a monk's head. You've seen pictures like this, and they had a dispute about the shape that shaving would take. And this is kind of a distressing focus upon externals that took place there, and it was a matter of controversy between the two groups. But ultimately, at a place called Whitby, a synod of Whitby, in 664, it was decided to adopt the Roman positions that were under discussion instead of the Celtic, so that within that generation, Catholic Christianity became the national faith of the English people. There was a Benedictine monk by the name of Bede, B-E-D-E, who wrote a book, an important book, called The Church History of the English People. And it's a really important source for understanding this history. Bede also translated the Gospel of John into English. So here you have another instance of the Bible being translated into the language of the people. Well, that's chapter 11, and I'm not dealing with the last chapter in part 1. It has to do with, I think, the history of the Monophysites, and it's of interest, but it's not a direct part of our history, and I tried to cut the assignments down to make this somewhat manageable, so you can read that for yourself, but I'm not going to deal with it here. Let me pause and give you opportunity for questions or comments. Well, part two begins with a chapter on Islam, and this is, I think, a subject that is quite relevant to us today. And the Islamic movement, and later on in its Turkish form, especially, has a very great impact on the church, and so it's important to look at this. Needham begins this chapter by talking about the dawn of the Middle Ages, and Wade asked me the question, or just in passing, when did the Middle Ages begin? Well, sometime about this period, but he said, Needham says there's no morning when somebody woke up and said, well, now we're in the Middle Ages. Historians look back at this, say, well, it was a time period that was different from what came before. So between the age of the fathers and the Reformation, in between, that's the Middle Ages. And Needham says that there are three changes which really mark the beginning of the Middle Ages, and the first one is the rise of Islam. And so that's why we have this chapter. The second is the end of the Monophysite controversy in which took place particularly in Egypt, or monophysitism was centered in Syria and Egypt, so there was conflict and debate between them and the Orthodox Catholics. But when the Muslims conquered Egypt and Syria, that put an end to the influence of the Monophysites, and they were people who believed in one nature of Christ, that he was not God and man, but kind of a mixture of the two. That put an end to that controversy. And then third is the birth of the Frankish Empire, and this has to do with Charlemagne, and we look at him in the next chapter. So a quick history about Islam. And Muhammad, the founder, was born in the city of Mecca, which is in the Arabian Peninsula, somewhere around 570, 571. And he grew up in a situation where there was quite a mixture of religions. There was a native paganism, polytheistic worship of many gods. There were Jews living there. There were monophysite Christians. There were Nestorians, Orthodox Christians. And then some, Needham says, that were just coming toward belief in one God, but not related particularly to any of these religions. But it would be influenced from the Jews and some and the various kinds of Christians, and then this kind of simple monotheism that would have influenced him toward the strong monotheism of the Islamic religion. In the year 610, he reported that he had received a revelation from the angel Gabriel. He would know that name Gabriel from the scriptures with which he would have had some contact. So he was persuaded by his wife to embrace this and to begin teaching what he believed he had received from Gabriel. And his teaching involved a strong monotheism. Allah is one. And an emphasis particularly on the power of Allah, Allah being the Arabic name for God. He had a high regard for Jesus as his own, as one of the prophets and one of his own forerunners. And he believed that Jesus was sinless. Apparently he believed in the virgin birth, but he did not, because of his strong monotheism, believe in the divinity of Christ. And he rejected the story of the death of Jesus. Muslim teaching is that in some way Jesus was at the last moment snatched away from the cross and did not, in fact, die on the cross. Muslims talk about the five pillars. These are practices that are required of faithful Muslims. The first is the confession, which is repeated frequently. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Muslims are required to pray toward the city of Mecca five times a day. We've seen many pictures of that. Third, to give charitable gifts to the poor. Fourth, to fast during the feast of Ramadan, which lasts for a month. And my understanding is they fast from between sunrise and sunset, but can eat at night so they don't starve during that month. And then, if possible, every Muslim is required to make a pilgrimage once during his lifetime to Mecca. And I remember reading an article in the National Geographic magazine long ago, written by a Muslim, because no non-Muslims are allowed in Mecca. But he was, I think, of British descent, but he was a Muslim and went there and reported on this great annual pilgrimage. And they have enormous crowds, 1 million or 2 million people. And seeing the pictures of that and reading about some of the conditions helps me to kind of picture the children of Israel in the wilderness. You know, it's hard to picture. How could you have a crowd of 1 million or 2 million people living in primitive conditions going through the wilderness? They had the manna from heaven. But the pilgrimage to Mecca at least pictures people going out where there aren't a lot of facilities and living for a time in the wilderness. That's something that is expected of Muslims if they are able to do it. Other teachings include the teaching of jihad, which means struggle, and Muslims can use it as the struggle to obey Allah, but also the struggle to spread Islam in the world. And certainly in the beginning, and I think since that time as well, that struggle to spread Islam has been done by way of military conquest. Needham comments that from the outset, Islam was a faith which spread by the sword. Now, we're coming across periods in history in which that's also true of Christianity. So we ought to be realistic about that. I think when we hear discussions of jihad in the media and so on. But for the first 300 years, I think it's useful to think about this, Christianity did not spread by the sword, but by believers who were under severe persecution for their faith. And it was in that time that the church had great growth and perhaps a purer kind of life than later on, when people did take up the sword or forced people to profess faith in Christ under threat of death. Holy Book of Islam is the Quran, made up of 114 messages dictated to Muhammad by Gabriel. They are called surahs. They're divisions of the Quran. And then there are traditions about Muhammad's life called the Hadith, which is also authoritative. In 622, Muhammad and his followers were forced to leave Mecca and went to Medina. And there the people of that city accepted Muhammad's teachings, and subsequently they went back to Mecca armed, conquered the city of Mecca in 630. And from that time on, it became the center of the life of the religion. And then within 100 years, Muslim armies had established an empire that reached from India to Spain. So this is an amazing thing, within 100 years. And Afghanistan is, of course, in the news, and strongly Muslim. It goes back to this time of conquest. And we don't often think, perhaps, of it being in Spain, but Islamic conquest, as we'll see, reached into Spain and France at the greatest extent of the movement. It doesn't come in our period, but later on, Islam in its Turkish form was was a great threat to Europe. And again, when I was in Romania, we had a lecture there on the history of the church in that area, and the man who gave the lecture talked about Muslim conquest that came up the Danube River, reached the city of Vienna in Austria. And during the Reformation time, there was great fear about the Turks who were invading from the east and threatening Western Europe. Well, the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century. Rome had fallen. There was still an emperor in the east, centered in Constantinople, but that Eastern Empire was badly divided. And it was divided religiously. The Monophysites were in Egypt and Syria. The Orthodox Catholics, those who followed the Creed of Chalcedon, were in Greece and the Balkans and Asia Minor. And then the Byzantine Empire conquered the Persians in 1622 to 1628. And because of that conquest, Persia and Egypt and Syria were defenseless against the onslaught of the Muslim armies. And so, as you would know, Islam took over that part of the world. Muslims captured Damascus, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Persia, Afghanistan, and northern India. Now today we have Pakistan, but you know that's the result of a division in England because of the Muslim character of Pakistan. In the West, they captured the Mediterranean islands and Asia Minor, what is now Turkey. But they failed at this point to defeat Constantinople. And so the Byzantine, the Eastern Empire, still had its headquarters in Constantinople. They captured Northwest Africa, and then from there invaded Spain and were victorious there in 718. They went on from there up into France and were defeated at the city of Tours in France in 732. And that's a really significant date because that marks the limit of the Islamic conquest in Europe. And they remained in Spain for a long time, in fact, until 1492, which is the year in which Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Right up to the beginning of the modern time. There was a division within Islam, and I promised you this last night. This is about as much as I know about it. After the death of Muhammad, there was a question as to who would succeed him as the leader of the movement. And there was a relative of his, a cousin, I think, who became the leader. His name was Ali. And then there were a group of people that said after that, the leader of the Muslims should be a descendant of this Ali. And they were called the Party of Ali, and the Arabic word for party is something like Shia. So that the Shiites today are the people who come from this line who believe that the leader of Islam should be a descendant, a lineal descendant of Muhammad. The other group, called the Sunnis, did not hold that. They thought that the leader of the movement should be selected by the sheikhs, Their name comes from the word suna, which refers to the threefold guiding authority of the movement, the Quran and the Hadith, and the Hadith, and then a third category of tradition of Muslim practice. So the Shiites hold to genealogical descent for leadership, and the Sunnis say we should be guided by the holy books, and that seems to be the basic difference between them. Only about 10% of the Muslims were Shiite, but they centered in Persia, which is now Iraq, so that the form of Islam in Iraq is Shiite. I'm sorry, in Iran. I didn't, that's an easy mistake to make. In Iran is Shiite. Part of the conflict historically between Iran and Iraq is because formerly Iraq was predominantly Sunni. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. So the conflict within Islam has continued. Well, in the period we're talking about, Muslim philosophers had an influence on medieval Christians, and there was some interchange back and forth. In fact, Greek philosophy came into Western Europe in large part through the influence of Muslim philosophers. What was like life under Islamic rule? Well, in Arabia, ethnic Arabs, were forced to embrace Islam or be killed. But other groups, and in other areas, Christians and Jews were tolerated but placed under restrictions. They had to pay special taxes, and particularly they were forbidden to evangelize Muslims. And it's not surprising then that Christian churches in the territories conquered by Muslims declined in number because of these limitations placed upon their life. But they tolerated Christians, and so, for example, there was a man by the name of John of Damascus, who lived from 1675 to 749, who was the prime minister of the caliph, who was the primary Muslim leader. He was his prime minister, and he wrote a book called The Exact Exposition of the Orthodox Faith. So he was able to live and function as a Christian believer, even in the circles of government in Islam. And Needham makes the point that Western European culture reached its highest development in Muslim Spain in the 10th century. He'd be thinking about art and education. Early universities were formed by the Muslims, and then Christian Europeans took over the idea of having universities. There were efforts to reach Muslims with the Christian gospel. A man by the name of Raymond Lull, who was a Franciscan monk, tried to evangelize Muslims in Northwest Africa and trained others for this work, and somehow was able to do that without being put to death. Francis of Assisi, that we know from other connections, also wrote books that tried to persuade Muslims of the truth of the gospel. And even Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic theologian, wrote a book. He called it Against the Gentiles, but it was really addressed to Muslims seeking to persuade them of the truth of Christianity. Those who wrote against Islam rejected Muhammad's claims to be a prophet. They called him a deceiver. They defended the doctrine of the Trinity and of the Incarnation. They rejected the fatalism of Islam, which held that God is the author of evil. And they tried to defend themselves against the charge of idolatry, relating to their devotion to Mary and to their use of icons and images. I think they had a hard job on that latter part, but they tried to persuade the Muslims that they were not, in fact, idolaters. That's a brief overview of Islam. Do you have questions? And if I can't answer them, Harold will. Okay, well, let's take a break at this point.